meeting at the dawn of the day. All the darkened kittens, the Millar's gray, are touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses. Oh, hear the people singing.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs, on the air since 1978. Making it the longest-running feminist radio program in the country. I'm your host this week, Leanne Kranz. Tonight, we welcome writer Alicia Abbott, author of Fairyland, a memoir of my father, published by W.W. Norton & Company. Fairyland gives us a child's eye view of the gay liberation movement in San Francisco in the 70s and 80s. From the awakening of the community after the Stonewall Uprising through the devastation of the AIDS epidemic. It is also a tribute to her father, the writer Steve Abbott, a pioneering single gay parent at a time before public role models, resources, or ways to connect. And we have two copies of Fairyland to give away as thank you gifts if you donate to KVU this hour. It is now my pleasure to welcome on the phone tonight from Cambridge, Massachusetts, Alicia Abbott.
Hi there. Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you for being our guest on a late Friday night where you are.
Yes. No, it's my pleasure. Absolutely.
You wrote this memoir, Fairyland, 20 years after your father, Steve Abbott, passed away. And what compelled you to tell your story at this time?
Well, I've been thinking about writing this story really since he died 20 years ago. Soon after, in this, about 6 months after he died, I was going through the closet of our house and I found a cache of his personal journals. And in among the journals, he wrote that he had a vision for a novel called A Gypsy Man's Daughter that would take place on his deathbed, and I would write about his boyfriends and use his diaries, and there'd be flash forwards and flash backwards. And so he sort of envisioned this story being told as a novel, and wrote this in 1975, you know, many years before I actually did care for him on his deathbed. And I really felt that the treasure trove of those journals was an invitation to tell our story. And I as well felt I was in a really unique position, both in that I don't think there's many stories have been told about the gay rights movement in San Francisco from the perspective of a child or from the perspective of an alternative family within that scene. And I just happened to have not only my father's journals detailing people he knew and things we did, but also his poems describing that time, and personal letters, and with all this material, I knew that I could tell a rich story.
And you do include so much of that in the memoir that you publish, pictures and snippets of writing and letters and poems. It really makes for a comprehensive telling of a life.
Thank you. Yes, I think I really wanted to be able to have my father's voice be present in the work, because this was a story he wanted to tell. And since I'm able to quote a lot from his letters and journals, I'm able to get his voice into that story. So I feel good about that.
And I guess we should mention that your mother passed away when you were a toddler. You were just about three, I understand. And I understand that through his journals, for the very first time, you were able to experience her in the present tense.
Yes, because she died when I was 2 and a half in a mm-hmm. car accident, I have no actual memories of her moving and of her alive at all. Everything I knew about her, I really knew from staring at photographs and hearing stories that were recounted to me by my uncle or my grandparents. And then suddenly, 6 months after my father's death, when I found these journals, I was able to glimpse their life together and watch them go shopping for tarot cards and just live their life. And it was very exciting, but of course I knew, you know, that the story I was reading in sort of real time was going to have a sad ending. So it was painful too.
Mm-hmm. When your mother passed away, it was quite clear in the reading that your father wanted you, even though your aunt offered to raise you, and there were your mother's parents who were in the mix as well. He wanted you. And even though he was at an age, I'm assuming he was in his 20s, and his life was just opening up. He was coming out as a gay man, and he decided to raise you and move to San Francisco and live in the midst of this revolution. I was very touched by that.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it is interesting because I knew that when my mother was first pregnant with me, I wasn't planned, and he had some ambivalence about their ability to raise a child under the situation that they were living. But then after I was born, he felt a real connection with me, and for a period when he was a student and later looking for work, and my mother was working full-time, he was something of a house husband with primary responsibility for me at points of the day, and, you know, at a time when men really didn't do that. Mm-hmm. But he was still pretty irresponsible in his day-to-day living at the point that my mother died. A number of his friends and other members of their community felt that he should let my grandparents or my aunt raise me because his life was so pathetic. He didn't have work. He and my mother and their friends had been taking a lot of drugs, and it was just a lot of instability. But he really felt after my mother died that, and his other, he at the time he was having, had been in love with another man, but who didn't love him back. That relationship was dissolving, and he really felt that I was all he had left in the world, and he was all that I had left in the world, and we needed to stay together. And so even though with my aunt offering to adopt me, he had an out from the responsibility of being a single father, he really felt determined to have primary custody and manage raising me. And he didn't see any impediment to doing that in San Francisco, you know, while also pursuing the bohemian life that he wanted there.
We are speaking with author Alicia Abbott. We're talking about her memoir, Fairyland, a memoir of her father. We have two copies to give away this hour for those who call in and donate to KBOO during our fall membership drive. Now we're going to invite Jimmy and Della to join the conversation.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, we have two copies of Fairyland, a memoir of my father. They're available for a $60 minimum pledge. And all you have to do to make that pledge is call 877-500-5266. We are here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, and we've even got some grub for you. If you come on down, we'll reserve some for you. And we are available on the internet at kboo.fm.
Hey, thanks for that, Jimmy. I'm Della Ray, and I am so excited to be here and to be talking to you from the very show that has my heart, Bread and Roses. And you can be a part of this, too. Just go online, kboo.fm, and hit that tip jar.
Or call 877-500-5266. We are in the home stretch, the last inning of our pitch drive. And we are looking at about a $14,000 remaining to get to our goal. And we're asking you to help us make that happen and do it now by calling 877-500-5266. We're here spending our time volunteering because we have a passion for radio. We enjoy what we bring to you through the airwaves, and we know that you enjoy it too because you're listening right now. And I'm speaking to you, dear listener, who has yet to contribute to this station for this pledge drive. Help us keep going strong. We are better than ever, and we continue to move in that direction every day. But we do that because you know how to operate a telephone, and when I tell you to dial these numbers, you go ahead and do it. It's 877-500-5266. We have those books available, Fairyland, a memoir of my father for a $60 minimum pledge. And let's go back to, Della?
Absolutely. Jimmy, you know what? This is what I always say. People ask me all of the time, what can I do? What's one thing I can do to simplify my life? And I always say, turn on community radio. That's KBOO.FM. You know, FM radio is accessible to just about everyone, even those with computers, without computers or smartphones. Here's an amazing way to connect with community, and it's right here, KBOO. I'm passionate about it. Here's your chance to join us. You can do that by dialing 877-500-5266.
We make it just that simple for you. We have electronic funds transfers. You don't even notice that the funds are being taken out of your account every month. And for just $5 a month is $60 a year. That goes such a long way toward keeping this type of programming available for you, keeping it strong. Let's hear you make those phone ring. Those phones ring out there in our listening area. It's 877-500-5266.
Welcome back. You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm your host tonight, Leanne, on the phone from Cambridge, Massachusetts. I cannot pronounce things tonight. Sorry, guys. On the phone tonight, we have Alicia Abbott, the author of Fairyland, a memoir of my father. Alicia, you mention in the text that I was more often than not the only child among adults and the only girl among men. This gives you a very unique point of view to the gay liberation movement. You were very much a part of your community, but also apart. How did this impact you growing up?
Well, you know, I always felt a bit an outsider, and I know a lot of people grow up in their life feeling an outsider, but I was put into a French bilingual school as a little girl with the help of my grandparents, but I knew at school I didn't know anyone with a gay parent. I was motherless, didn't have any siblings, and I was living with my dad at home with sort of a rotating cast of roommates and going to poetry readings at night while all my classmates were sort of children of businessmen and diplomats. And then when I would go with my father out to parties, I mean, he was happy often to have me with him. I feel like I was kind of an extension of his sort of poet persona, you know, with his own daughter. But at the same time, a lot of the people we spent time with in the poetry community as well as in the gay community were trying to escape responsibility. They were not family men. They were people who wanted to try out new roles and take drugs or, you know, be free of concerns and responsibility and worry. And sometimes having a small child running around was a reminder that you had to, of the responsibilities you weren't taking. Or, you know, in some ways I was a bit too straight for the gay world, but also a little too gay for the straight world. But at the same time, it was really exciting for me because of the singularity in my position. I felt sometimes like I could be the only woman in my father's life, the only girl in my father's life, because he didn't have as many relationships with women. And so that gave me a sense of that I was very special to him, which I was. But mm-hmm. I think in some ways when he and I went out alone to restaurants, in my mind I felt like we were on dates. That there was something really private and, unique, intense about our affections for each other, our relationship.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a fantasy for any daughter, you know, to have her father's undivided attention, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I had some of his, he divided his attention between me and his work and his other pursuits, but I felt like he had no relationship in his life like the relationship he had with me, mm-hmm. because I didn't have any siblings to share his time with, And as well, he, you know, and like I said before, he did see having a child as an extension of his poet persona. He felt in that era, he was trying to get to his more childlike self, a wonder of looking at the world that he could express through his poetry. And here I was, you know, a 7-year-old or a 6-year-old running around with just that perspective he wanted. So he would sometimes quote me in his poems or take my childhood drawings to illustrate his poems. And he felt in some ways like I think I kept him having a foot in that fairyland of pretend and imagination.
Mm-hmm. Which that spirit was very much in the air in the dawn of the counterculture.
And that was a lot of why people were attracted to moving to San Francisco in the 70s and into the Haight-Ashbury where we lived. You know, people think about the Haight-Ashbury as a hippie neighborhood, but it actually had a very vibrant gay identity that, unlike the Castro, where gay identities were often put sort of front and center, in the Haight-Ashbury, it fit into a larger bohemian mosaic. And so you had a very mixed community of single mothers and gay couples, but like everyone had in common a desire to experiment and put on shows and dress up and be characters and personas. And there was really, in the era that we were there, a culture of kind of supporting each other through this exploration. Like, in some ways, I felt like we had an alternative family that wasn't just my father and I, but at different points extended to our roommates or our neighbors.
Mm-hmm. We've mentioned that your father was a pioneer as a single father raising a young daughter, as well as being a gay parent before there were as many public role models and resources. And he was also a pioneer in the sense, as many parents were during the dawn of the counterculture, they were trying to parent in a new way, trying to be different than their parents or how they were raised. So he was kind of operating without a map, making it up as he went along, it seemed. And you convey that if he was imperfect in his parenting at times, his intentions were solid. They were very good. Can you elaborate a little bit on his parenting style and some of the challenges or triumphs?
Well, as I said, I had access to my father's journals, and so I read about his descriptions of our life together, but I also read about him describing his childhood. And he grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska in the 1950s and 60s in a middle-class Irish Catholic home, and it was a very repressed environment. He described his house having all the joy of a funeral home, and he didn't feel that he could be his true self, let alone be openly gay. And so I think that he wanted, in raising me, to have the kind of open communication and affection and transparency and sort of self-actualization that he didn't feel in his own family. I knew that my mother and father, when they met in graduate school, were both fans of the psychologist R.D. Lang. And R.D. Lang viewed that if an individual was sick, it was because the society around him was sick. And I think for both my parents, they really felt that traditional family models and even gender relations could be corrosive to the individual. And so I think when my father was raising me, he sort of saw as an opportunity to experiment with the kind of family that he wanted to have, perhaps, which was one of communication and honesty. If he was punishing me, he would let me weigh in on what my punishment should be, or he would often talk me through things and treating me as an equal or an adult. Sometimes he let me have a little too much responsibility, asking me for boyfriend advice or leaving me on my own a lot to fend for myself with money to buy food in the neighborhood after school. But I really felt that all of the efforts that he was making, he really was always coming from a place of love and wanting to both provide me freedom and opportunities to be happy, but also to not be frustrated creatively himself. So he didn't want to, say, give up on his aspirations to be a poet and writer in the city. And, you know, he didn't take a straight 9-to-5 job, which would have made him miserable, but might have given me a little bit more stability. But he felt that if he was a poet and he could take me out to poetry readings, that would enrich my life too. Mm-hmm. And so I think from the vantage point of 2013, and now I'm a mother myself with two young children, there were times that he made decisions that I definitely wouldn't make today, that I felt he was giving me a little too much responsibility. But especially now, with my perspective as an adult, I really do see that he was, you know, really always thinking about my welfare and, you know, just really coming from an honest, loving place.
We're speaking with writer Alicia Abbott, author of Fairyland, A Memoir of My Father. We'll welcome back Della Ray and Jimmy to the conversation.
Thank you so much. Yes, we have copies of Fairyland by Alicia Abbott available, a memoir of her father. And I'm really listening to a couple of things that Alicia's been sharing with us about, especially like her comment about how she felt like her father was engaging in some experimental parenting. And that's what you get when you support KBOO Radio, is experimental radio. Sometimes you'll hear experimental music. Sometimes you'll hear experimental angles on issues of the day. You'll hear experiments in truth. And that's because you have gone to the phone and dialed 877-500-5266 to help make this community-supported radio happen. It's time for you to step up to the plate. We're in the last inning of our pledge drive, and we need you to go ahead. You've been putting it off. It's time to make it happen.
Absolutely. Jimmy, I'm just so happy to be here with you and with all these people that are here that are volunteering to make this happen, to bring this content to you, to bring music to you, to bring community to you. If you just found us, welcome, and please join our member-supported, listener-supported community. This is why we call this community radio. We're building a larger and larger community of discerning listeners just like you, and we'd like you to include you right now. Go to KBOO.FM, hit the tip jar, let us know how you feel about the amazing programming that's brought just for you. You can also dial 877-500-5266.
That's right. Discerning listeners, you're listening to KBOO. You could be dialing your radio to any of those stations out there that are slinging whatever they're slinging, but instead you've decided that your time is worth spending with us, and now is time for you to prove it to us. Make it real. Make the commitment. The number is 877-500-5266. I want to mention a couple of folks who have made that commitment. Thomas, renewing member in Southeast Portland. Thank you, sir. Susan, a renewing member in Southeast Portland. Thank you, ma'am. And Marcus dropped by the station. He's a new member in Southwest Portland. He was telling us that he's been putting it off, and now it's the last day. We're less than 24 hours left in our pledge drive. It's time for you. You've been holding on to that cash. You got a little bit of a nest egg squirreled away, a little extra left over. Send it our way. We promise that we will put it to good use. It won't go to new carpeting and new furniture, I can tell you that much. It will go to new microphones. It will go to continuing to power the antenna to broadcast this signal to you so that you can have this quality community radio station bringing you, like Alicia was mentioning, honest, loving content that's thinking about your welfare. We're all in this together. That's why we spend our time here volunteering. That's why we are positive about KBOO, and it's time for you to go ahead and give us that feedback that you feel the same. It's 877-500-5266.
Yeah, and you know, media, absolutely, the consolidation of media is at an all-time high, and local news shows like KBOO and programming is so rare. You know it. I know it. I want to hear the phones ring. You want to make them ring. Let's do it. 877-500-5266, or you can go online, kboo.fm, and hit that tip jar. And we absolutely want to thank the people today that brought in food to keep us all going. Eclectic Kitchen, 4936 Northeast Fremont Street. Thank you. Vita Cafe, 3203 Northeast Alberta Street. Thank you so much. And of course, Dina Cola's Restaurant, 3520 Southeast Powell Boulevard. And you can get involved. You still can. 877-500-5266. Call now.
Yes, thank you to our food donors. Thank you to all our volunteers. And thank you to you. You're thinking about making the commitment. You're thinking about picking up that phone. I want to thank you in advance. The number 877-500-5266. We promise to make it easy on you. As easy as it is to listen to KBOO, all you got to do is turn on the radio and dial us in and then sit back and be informed, be delighted, be entertained by stuff you're not going to find anywhere else because it's the stuff that you want. You know that there's a lack in the quote-unquote mainstream media. You know there's a lot of stuff that's left unsaid out there, and that's why you tune in to KBOO because you know we're going to bring it to you. Pick up the phone. It's time, folks. We're getting into the last hours of this pledge drive. The number is 877-500-5266. Make the call now.
Thank you, Delaray and Jimmy. You're listening to Bread and Roses. Our guest tonight is writer Alicia Abbott, author of Fairyland, a memoir of my father, a child's eye view of the gay liberation movement, and a young girl's account of being raised by a single gay father in 70s and 80s San Francisco. Alicia, your memoir, it provides an American history lesson for all of us on the gay liberation movement. You trace the spark that catalyzed it all, the Stonewall riots, and then the emerging communities and the identity that surfaced after that, the early gay pride parades, Anita Bryant's Save the Children campaign, and Harvey Milk, the first public official, openly gay who was ever elected, and then his assassination. And you end up with the AIDS epidemic. I know you were very small during some of these events. Can you talk to us about how your awareness began? How did you perceive some of these events as a small child and young woman?
Well, I think my earliest memories in San Francisco were really about this sense of community that was coming together. I mean, there was a lot of excitement when my father and I first arrived in 1974. It was 5 years after Stonewall. Homosexuality was removed from the list of mental illnesses. You could express yourself without being diagnosed as sick. And there was a lot of people coming to the city from towns where they had to live secret lives and to a place where they can kiss and hold hands in public. So there was a lot of joy and a sense of a utopian celebration. Certainly when I would go with my father to the Castro, I think that I was really attracted to this warmth that I saw, and I sort of wanted to be a part of it. And in some ways I was a part of it, but I also knew that that I was different too. I was a girl. I wanted to be a boy at first. Option wasn't available to me. And then as the decade progressed, I knew, Anita Bryant was an orange juice promoter in Florida, and she was leading a campaign to save the children and was trying to repeal gay rights ordinances across the country, and did in several states, including Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And in San Francisco and in across the country, there was a boycott of orange juice. And so our family would drink apple juice. And that was just what we did. And everyone we knew would drink apple juice in the mornings. And these were the ways that I could understand them when I was small. But I think that there was also a sense of unity that in having the common threat of Anita Bryant and Senator John Briggs, who tried to pass a proposition making it illegal to be a gay teacher, there was a sense of we have to stick together, we have to work together, support each other, form unions, help provide legal services to gay mothers who might lose their children in adoption battles. I mean, sorry, in custody battles, and this really brought people together. And that was an energy you could pick up at Gay Pride Parade, but there was also a lot of organizing. My father, as a poet and part of a poetry collective, wrote a poem about Anita Bryant, which he read on the local community radio station, and he felt that this was, it was an important time to stand up and to have a voice and to say, you know, we're not the gay men and women of a decade or two ago who are going to go back into the closets and shrink from the negative attention. We're here and we're fighting, and that was very exciting to be a part of, even if I didn't always understand what was quite at stake. And certainly, I was more aware of the AIDS crisis because at that point that was making headlines. I was a teenager, but it was, you know, there was still so much stigma around AIDS, and it was so closely aligned with the gay community that I think as a result, I was really pushed into the closet myself, or rather I pushed myself into the closet because I was afraid of what classmates or strangers might say or think about me. Not that they would assume that I had AIDS or that my father had AIDS, but I think I was just very scared, and so I tried to keep a low profile. I really felt in researching this book and digging into old newspapers and magazines and reading other books that this was a really exciting period of American history, and I don't think it should be relegated to queer studies classrooms. I think that there are heroes in the fight for gay rights that are inspiring, that is part of a history that we all share, that's part of even a traditionally American struggle for the ability to pursue happiness and without, you know, with freedom of judgment, that you should find tolerance. I was just really excited I felt that because I had a personal story that it might be a way in for people who might otherwise not learn about this history, to be able to put it into a context and not just see numbers, but to see faces. And to know that, you know, that there's a lot that we can learn and take away and be inspired by with the history of the gay rights movement. I mean, I'm really inspired by it.
And I was, too, reading the book. I got a real education. And there are these important lessons to remember. Our government was inactive about AIDS for a terrible amount of time. And you point out that at the time, the lesbian community was more aligned perhaps with the women's movement and had not much interaction with the gay men's community. But when under attack, they really came together and because they recognized the connection of gay rights and human rights.
That's right. And as well, in the AIDS crisis, the lesbian community really came together and conducted blood drives and marched in rallies to bring faster and cheaper access to drugs. And it was really a sense of the community taking care of itself because there was a sense that the larger government was not taking seriously what was going on because they viewed the gay community at that time as a marginalized community. I mean, they still do in many ways, but it was under the Reagan administration and the Bush administration, there was really a sense of, well, you know, people who have AIDS, they have AIDS because of choices that they made, and they're not a priority. It wasn't until AIDS seemed to be entering into the straight community that more money was funneled in towards research. But it's, for me, it's a shameful time in the history in terms of what many members of government did, but it's a heroic time in the history for how the community of San Francisco and other members of the gay community across the country came together.
Mm-hmm. You know, you make a correlation in this book that I think is really important to talk about. You mentioned that when the public climate is brewing with anti-gay sentiment, during the Anita Bryant Save the Children campaign, for example, in the late 70s, you remember feeling that they don't want us. You understood the sense of persecution even as a seven-year-old. And you point out that gay bashing increased incredibly during the Anita Bryant era as well as during AIDS. There's that direct correlation. And you had a sense of dread for your father's safety.
Well, I was aware as a teenager of, I saw a lot of anti-gay graffiti that sprayed around San Francisco and on the Muni buses. And I read about and heard about stories of men being targeted and beat up. Mm-hmm. And obviously there was a tremendous amount of fear during the AIDS crisis, and people didn't know what to do with that fear and anger. And so oftentimes that came out in violence during the Anita Bryant era. I mean, she talked about, you know, she equated members of the gay community with garbage and talked about the immorality of a place like San Francisco. And so with that kind of language comes a license to say, okay, these are people who are beneath us. You know, it opens up the door for people to express violence. And I think often that is a fear, especially if people, you know, felt that they themselves maybe had urges that were somehow very shameful, that they would have to act out to prove to themselves that they were straight. So, I mean, it's all very complicated, but, you know, at the same time, it mirrored periods of progress and visibility. I mean, during Anita Bryant, as much as she was harmful to the community, she really galvanized the community, and she brought gay rights to the cover of Newsweek in the summer of 1977, and suddenly people were talking about gay rights in living rooms, and Harvey Milk was urging people to come out in their communities so that people could see, wow, you know, my postman's gay. Like, it's, you know, a lot of people I know are gay, and that progress has continued. But I do think that revolution, you know, in sort of social revolution, sexual revolution, doesn't happen without a little bloodshed, meaning that, like, people are really threatened by change and will act out in violent ways, as we're seeing, you know, across the globe, as gay rights is gaining ground, different communities react with violence.
I was also, it seemed that much of the gay bashing that occurred happened among teenagers. Is that a trend that was observed at the time?
Well, I mean, I think it wasn't, I personally observed gay bashing with teenagers. I mean, I think that there was definitely in the mainstream culture among teenagers and kids, there was a lot of slang of, you know, don't be a homo and that's so gay and, you know, that guy's a faggot. Like, just really horrible ways of speaking that reflected sort of a larger cultural discomfort and intolerance. And, you know, that I absorbed that, and that's part of why I felt scared to speak out until I was older. I was too young to witness much violence firsthand, but I did see a lot of anti-gay graffiti, and I was, you know, I was just scared. You know, I think members of the gay community were also scared. What was interesting was even reading my father's journals. Like, he didn't write very much about AIDS. It was almost like he was avoiding it as a topic. But after I was finished with my project, I did take some time to look up names of different friends of his in the 80s, and there's a database with the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco in coordination with the Bay Area Reporter. There's an online database of obituaries you can look up, and I was able to look up the obituaries of, I found members of my dad's community who died of AIDS, and just even to find those and then read about their lives and when they died, I mean, it was just a huge amount of loss that I feel. I mean, I was vaguely aware of, just in an abstract sense. I mean, I'm certainly aware of with the close friends we lost or losing my father, but just the weight of that loss on the community at large, just how many people died so young and so needlessly, it was kind of overwhelming. But I think for me, a way of honoring those losses were to illuminate the stories mm-hmm. of some of the people we knew, and also just to admit that was sad, you know, just to say that shouldn't have happened, and to let myself cry and say mm-hmm. is a way of having those deaths not be in vain, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Alicia Abbott, author of Fairyland, a memoir of my father. We have copies to give away this hour if you call KBOO and pledge your support. Della Ray and Jimmy can tell you more about that.
Right.
Yes, we can. And let me tell you, the number once again is 877-500-5266. There is one thing that I am acutely aware of, is that we are only $13,000 from our goal, and we are here to ask you, to compel you to go to the phone and dial 877-500-5266. You're part of this community already because you're out there listening, and it's time for you to let us know that we're part of your community. Pledge your support to KBOO right now, 877-500-5266. I don't mean in a few minutes. I mean right now. Pick up the phone and make the call.
You know, think about this. Think about $5 a month. That's a yearly gift of $60. $5 a month. You can do that by going to kboo.fm. And you can hit that tip jar and give to such an amazing community effort that supports you and that brings things for you. 877-500-5266.
Part of the training that we receive here free by KBOO is training to do this right here, to make these what we call pitches for pledges of support. And one of the things that they like to remind us is that you out there, listeners, you pledge your support for your reasons. And I want to know what your reasons are. I want someone to call right now, 877-500-5266. Pledge your support and let us know why you're pledging your support. You're part of this community, like I said earlier, and it's time for you to go ahead and stand up and be counted among us. We're here. We're not going anywhere. We're going to keep on doing what we do. Help us to keep moving forward strongly. We still have copies of Fairyland, A Memoir of My Father by Alicia Abbott available. Della was mentioning a $60 minimum pledge. It's a sustaining member. That's $5 a month. That's all you've got to pitch in for. That's all you've got to be responsible for. You'll receive a copy of this book. And you're going to listen to the radio differently. When you're listening to KBOO and you're a vested member of what's going on here, you're going to be attuned a little bit more. You're going to be paying just a little bit more attention because you want us to get it right and you want to hear high quality content brought to you. We need you to help us make that happen by dialing 877-500-5266. Call now.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. Our guest tonight is Alicia Abbott, author of Fairyland, A Memoir of My Father, provides a child's eye view of the gay liberation movement and a young girl's account of being raised by a single gay father in 1970s and 80s San Francisco. Alicia, some of the most gorgeous writing in this book, and there is a lot. My favorite part, I think, is, I hope you don't mind talking about the final hours of your father's life. There was a scene when you're looking at his hands and remembering those hands in so many kind of everyday circumstances, memories of you watching your father do various household chores and all the hugs and supportive pats and everything. And I just wanted to mention that, first of all. It was very moving, and I burst into tears, you know.
Thank you.
Literally.
Sorry about that. Sorry I had to make you cry.
No, that's you want an ending to be like that. And it was very beautiful, very well done. I wondered if you, actually, what I want to ask you is, you mentioned you lived so much of your adolescence feeling that you needed to keep secrets about your father and your identity as a member of the gay community in San Francisco, just so that you could fit in. How did you get to the point where you could be so brutally honest about yourself and, you know, and really tell this story so honestly? How did you get to that place?
Well, I've had a lot of time to sit with this story. I've had some time to grow up myself. Mm-hmm. So my father died 4 days before my 22nd birthday. Normally, people go through a period of forgiving their parents for their sort of misdeeds and seeing them for the nuanced, you know, faulty humans that they are much later in life, mm-hmm. often when you're have your own kids or when you are just reach an age in life where you're like, okay, my parents not only not perfect, but also I can see, you know, the struggles he or she has, and I can accept their, you know, that person's limitations and love them all the more, you know, after through that process of understanding and kind of acceptance and forgiveness. You know, I didn't really have that opportunity during my father's life. I think when you're with someone who's terminally ill, you have fantasies that you're going to have these final transcendent conversations where you're going to reveal your secrets, you know, say all your greatest regrets. There'll be these sort of profound statements on the meaning of life. And, you know, the reality is that you're just still trying to make it through each day and figuring out what you're going to have for lunch and how to get to the store. And those profound conversations, that sense of connection that I think I learned to expect from watching movies or reading books, didn't happen in the way that I expected. I definitely felt that spending my father's final months with him, nursing him in my home and then moving him into a hospice, I felt that that was an act of intimacy, you know, mm-hmm. for me to be able to help him to the bathroom or clip his toenails. I mean, those are all acts that you do that involve trust and intimacy, but I didn't realize, I was still too young and I think caught up in my own sense of suffering and loss. I was an orphan. I was going to be an orphan, and I had some of my friends of my father's helping, but I didn't have any other family helping. And I think during my father's life, I was a little bit more focused on that experience, and it really took the process of time to realize how hard it must have been for him to be knowing that he was, you know, that he was sick and that he was going to have to leave me mm-hmm. so young and not be able to, you know, fix that. And I was able to even sort of see myself now with the selfishness that I had then. Like, not only can I recognize it in myself as a 21-year-old, but from the vantage point of the 42-year-old I am now, I can forgive that of myself and know that, like, that was the best, I was doing the best I could under the circumstances. And my father, not only at the end of his life, but when he was younger and he was trying to make a life for us in San Francisco and struggling to make ends meet without a steady partner and without a lot of guidance and input, he was doing the best that he could under the circumstances. You know, both of us were imperfect, like most people, but the love we felt for each other was very real, and the closeness that we had was very real. And in a way, even though I've spent half of my life without my father, I feel like I knew him so much, so deeply, during our life together I feel in some ways like I got to know my father better in the 20 years than some people might in mm-hmm. their lives
yeah.
get to know a parent, you know, and some of that is because I have access to his personal writings, but a lot of it is is my wanting to, I think because I miss him and he isn't in my life, I have a desire to understand him and his motivations and to forgive him and to understand the culture he came out of and what he was struggling with. And if I'm going to be honest about his mistakes, I knew that I would have to be honest about my own, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of honesty that you wrote about, like it has to be a two-way street. And I knew that I was taking risks by showing myself as a surly teenager, that, you know, I might have some readers not like me at different points. But I felt that if I tried to make myself look good or my father look good in places, that readers can see through that. Mm-hmm. And I just felt that if that honesty was being directed by a desire to tell a story and to share a moment as faithfully as I could, that people would see themselves in our story and they would be able to be more affected by it. And that was what was important. You know, ultimately I wanted to, you know, have people be able to find themselves in the story.
We're listening to Alicia Abbott, author of Fairyland, a memoir of my father. We have about 10 more minutes for you to get a copy of this book. Della Ray and Jimmy, please join us.
877-500-5266. Why do I keep repeating that number? Because that's the number that you need to know. That's the number that you need to call. Go ahead and do it. It'll be so easy after that point. And you'll be an invested member of this radio station, your community radio at KBOO. We're on the web, KBOO.FM. And we're here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Come down and visit.
Absolutely. And I keep saying the same thing. $5 a month. You can do $5 a month. That's $60 a year to become a member of this very important piece of our community. 877-500-5266. Or you can go online, kboo.fm, and you can hit that tip jar and donate. You are here. You're listening. You understand how important this community radio is because you're here and you know what we bring to you. Please, now is the time, 877-500-5266.
It takes a little bit of explanation sometimes to understand what it means for you to call 877-5066. Excuse me, 877-500-5266. That will get you through to our phones. What it means for you to make that call and become a member of this community, it's easy to kind of not really understand what it means to be representing for marginalized communities and what it means to those communities to have their voices heard, their perspectives shared. Imagine this part of the country, this region without KBOO bringing that to you. I'll be the first to admit that we're not perfect. We make mistakes on the air all the time. But the reason that it continues is because we're driven by passion. We're not here to make a buck. We're not here at the behest of somebody who's telling us what to say and how to say it and when to say it, etc., etc. We're here because we are bringing parts of our very own lives to you and sharing them with you because we feel that they're worth being shared. And obviously, 45 years proves that you feel that it's worth sharing, and you support us by calling 877-500-5266 or going on the internet at kboo.fm. Make that pledge. We're not asking for a whole lot here, folks, but when we put it all together, we make magic. We make things happen that you really have to stop and think what's going on here for a second. They're just that profound.
That's right. You know, we ask for your help twice a year. That's it. We come to you two times a year. But think about what you get in between those two times a year. You can join in, 877-500-5266.
And I want to thank Brooke for calling and pledging her support. Brooke, you've now part of this family here. Thank you so much. She called 877-500-5266. That's how she made it happen. And we make it easy for you to be part of it. Do it. Do it now, 877-500-5266.
We're speaking with Alicia Abbott, author of Fairyland, a memoir of my father. We have five more minutes to call in and get a copy. Alicia, in just the few minutes that we have left, do you mind, I know you've written, recently wrote about your thoughts on how your father would feel about the current state of gay rights. Do you mind talking about that?
Sure. Well, I was looking through my father's papers and I saw that he had written about gay fatherhood when I was about 5 years old, 4 or 5 years old in 1975. And he was contemplating a future on what and wondering what gay rights and gender relations might be like in the future. And he wrote, you know, I'm not trying to raise Alicia to be gay. I'm not trying to hide my gayness so that she can be straight. I just am showing her that there's many different kinds of ways to be, and I hope by the time she's an adult that gay, straight, male, female won't be so important and people are just going to be free to live as they feel most comfortable in being. And it was very moving for me to read that because in some ways we have made progress and that gay men and women can marry in many states in the country, but there's still a lot of debate and we still have farther to go. And I think I just know that my father was really committed to into civil rights and the progress of the gay rights movement. And so I feel with each milestone within that movement, I think of him and wish that I could share these moments with him.
Alicia Abbott, I want to thank you for being our guest tonight. The book Fairyland, A Memoir of My Father, is beautiful. It was very moving to me. And thank you for writing it for all of us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on and having me be part of your pledge drive. I'm a big supporter of community radio and I'm, you know, glad to help in any way that I can.
Yay, thank you for that. And folks, if you want to learn more about Alicia Abbott, go to her website, I'm going to spell Alicia. It's A-L-Y-S-I-A, Abbott, A-B-B-O-T-T.com. www.aliciaabbott.com. The book is Fairyland, A Memoir of My Father. I have to thank Elizabeth Riley at W.W. Norton for the generous donation of books for our fall membership drive and for arranging this interview. Thank you for donating, everyone, Brooke and Susan and others. Thank you for your continued support of KBOO and Bread and Roses. I would like to go out with a song dedicated to our guest, Alicia Abbott, and her father, the writer, Steve Abbott, and to all of us who have been impacted by AIDS. This is by the Co-Stars, featuring members of Luscious Jackson. This is Don't Know Why. Good night, everybody, and thanks, Alicia.
Good people, KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Afro-Caribbean All Music Festival. 9 bands will play genres and rhythms all originating from Africa, including Afro Jazz, Calypso, Samba, Salsa, Reggae, and others. The event will feature the bands Jujuba, Love Nesuesa, Super Mokako, Roots Revolution, and others. The festival will be held on November 1st, 2nd, and 3rd at the TAQ Center, 631 Northeast Grand Avenue, Portland, from 7 p.m. until 2:30 a.m. Come dance for 3 nights straight at the Afro-Caribbean All Music Festival, November 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. More information can be found on the right-hand side of the KABU.FM website under Community Events.
The time is 7:01. You are listening to KBOO Portland.
As we come to the last hours of KBOO's membership drive, we bring you a Pacifica Archive special, Voices of Feminism. The first speaker on this special is Congresswoman Maxine Waters.
There is no war on drugs going on in America today. And Barry McCaffrey needs to resign right now. He needs to stop pushing policies that send our tax dollars to Colombia, supporting these right-wing dictator types. And move out of the way and allow us to develop some good